Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be doing the second in our series on hope for rare diseases, mitochondrial disease. And we're looking forward to talking with Amber Greenwalt about this today.
Yeah, you know, we had a fascinating conversation, Christy, a couple months ago, talking about Fabry disease, and we learned so much. And mitochondrial disease is something else that I don't think doctors and patients know enough about, and so we really look forward to having this conversation. But first, we've also got some really interesting research that matters today, Christy, about things that maybe a lot of people don't know that much about. I didn't know.
We're going to talk about beets and apps for weight loss and diet and menopause and discharge after angioplasty.
We're going to span the spectrum here. Let's dive right into our very first research that matters about high blood pressure in beetroot juice. Had you ever heard of beetroot juice? That's a hard one to say four times really fast. Beetroot juice, but had you heard of it?
I hadn't heard of it because we don't say the H word hate in our house, but if I was allowed to say it, I would say it in how I feel about beets. I don't like beets at all.
Well, I wouldn't have known that. And so you certainly are not going to like beetroot juice.
Sounds awful.
Well, I think a lot of people, I was thinking about growing up and watching and seeing older people drinking prune juice. And I thought the same thing. But beetroot juice, it might just be one of these things that if people really knew it was healthy or like carrot juice, they would take it more regularly. And let's think about what did they find in this particular study.
So in this study, they found that drinking a cup of beetroot juice a day might help reduce blood pressure. And a blood pressure decrease of about 10 millimeters of mercury, which is, you know, more than some starting doses of blood pressure medicines.
Right. And they actually found that there was only 15 people, so this was not a large study, and they had mild high blood pressure. It wasn't moderate or severe, but they took this beetroot juice or water, that was the comparison, and they followed them, you know, to see how their blood pressure responded, and they found this significant decrease. Now, there's some problems with this study.
Well, lots of problems with the study. It was small, and I mean, there were a variety of things that were a problem, but there is a potential explanation because the beets have this high dietary nitrate content in them, which gets changed by the body, and there is, you know, nitric oxide is something that does affect blood vessels. So there's like a logical link to how having higher nitrates in your diet might affect your blood pressure in a positive way.
I think, Christy, they must
have...
This
doesn't prove it.
No, and I think they must have excluded people who hate beet juice because...
That's true. I was not in the study.
Because, yeah, I think that visceral reaction to it...
that would drive my blood pressure up.
More to come, but if you are drinking some beetroot juice, you might be helping your blood pressure. Let's listen to our very next research that matters. And this is about an article that actually, Christy, we were talking about, I think it was last week, about a New England Journal of Medicine article for weight loss with patients with mental illness. And I actually referenced a health application about obesity in this particular article because I'd read both of them about the same time. And so it is this article we're actually talking about that was in the Journal of Internet Medical Research, this particular health app called My Meal Mate.
Yeah, so My Meal Mate is not what was done in the other study, but in this one it was used to see if a free health app that allowed you to log your food made a difference in 128 patients who were overweight compared with a paper food journal or an online food diary using the computer.
And they actually followed these patients out and found that those who were using this health app lost on average about 10 pounds over the period of time that they were doing this study, over 6 months, compared to 3 to 6 pounds of those who did the food diary. This doesn't say what happened after they stopped the study, which is one of the criticisms I have, because a lot of diets and other more high intervention things work for a short period of time. On the other hand, this was a free health app by the British Health Service, the National Health Service in Great Britain, that people can download, and we'll ask our health science librarians to put the link on this for us on our website.
I completely agree. It's free. It's probably got very little harm to it. So I say go for it. Let's talk also about diet related to menopause. This was a study looking at 6,000 women followed over 9 years who ate a lot of strawberries, pineapple, melon, and followed a Mediterranean-style diet to see what happened with their symptoms of menopause.
And this was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And we know that there's not a lot of really good treatments that doctors recommend for menopause today in terms of medications, because some of the side effects of the hormone medications, we're less likely to prescribe them. And so this question was, would a Mediterranean-style diet with some emphasis on fresh fruit in this particular case reduce hot flashes? And they looked at over 6,000 women between the ages of 50 to 55 and followed them.
And found that the people who followed the Mediterranean-style diet and ate those fruits were about 20% less likely to report the common symptoms of hot flashes and sweating. And the women who ate high-sugar, high-fat diets were 23% more likely to have hot flashes and night sweats during the study. You know, it's an association. We can't say for sure that if you change to this Mediterranean diet with fruits, that's going to lower your hot flashes. But it certainly suggests that this is one other potential benefit.
Yeah, Christy and I were several months ago talking about strawberries and blueberries. Oh, my. Now we're going to have to say strawberries, pineapples, melon, blueberries. Oh, my. There's real benefits probably from fresh fruits and vegetables. This is one of them that's at least worth, I think, giving patients options. This is one I would give.
Sure. Okay, let's talk about how long a patient should stay in the hospital after having angioplasty, which is a procedure to check out and improve blood flow to the heart.
This was in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And over 500,000 angioplasties are performed in the United States every year, Christy. I didn't know there were that many, but that's an awful lot. And they reviewed over 12,000 patients that had had these procedures to see, well, is it safe to actually go home on the same day after you've had the procedure? And the answer was?
The answer was probably in certain cases. So as they looked at, again, over 12,000 patients in the review, they really found no difference in the number of complications among patients who were sent home on the same day compared with those who were kept overnight in the hospital, particularly in patients who were in generally of good health, were younger than 75, weren't having an acute heart attack or anything, or having any allergy to the contrast.
Right. And we have to remember, this is in studies, and this does not mean that it's all the same of what happens when you have that conversation with your doctor, because many of these patients actually were willing to go home. So I think if you're a patient that, for whatever reason, maybe lives further away, maybe you have some kidney problems, maybe you really don't want to go home because you don't feel it's safe, this study really doesn't apply to you. But if, on the other hand, you have good care, you're close to the hospital, and you'd like to go home, it may well be safe. Talk with your doctor.
Absolutely. So we've talked a little bit about the going home after an angioplasty, about a health app that's free.
About diet for menopause, and about Christy's favorite, we're going to bring her a glass next week, of beetroot juice.
Yuck. Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Amber Greenwalt about the second in our series on hope for rare diseases, mitochondrial disease. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL. and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Amber Greenewalt about mitochondrial disease. And this is the second in our series on hope for rare diseases. Welcome to Your Health, Amber.
Hi, thank you.
We are grateful that you're willing to share with us and here to talk about mitochondrial disease. I know we want to talk about what it is, but tell us how this became for you as an advocate, something that has been so near and dear in your life.
Well, we have three children, and our oldest has a very, very rare, or had, I should say, a very, very rare type of tumor. And we have several places here in Charlotte that I could take him for treatment. And then when Savannah came along, our youngest who has mitochondrial disease, there was nowhere really any doctor in the city, fairly large city of Charlotte, North Carolina, that we live in, that I could take her for treatment or to find a doctor who really was even specialized in it. So Chapel Hill is actually the closest we were able to find a mitochondrial disease specialist. And so I started to realize that there was a huge disparity between the cancer realm that we were in and the mitochondrial disease realm, and yet the two diseases were very similar in the amount of people that they affected.
Well, let's, for our listeners out there, let's set the stage for this. You've just set up the situation that the rate, the incidence, the number of people who have childhood cancers is about the same as those who have this condition called mitochondrial disease, and you find out about it from your immediate family. Help us understand what is mitochondrial disease, because most people might not have heard of this.
Sure. I certainly didn't know what it was when I first started dipping my toes into this realm. So mitochondrial diseases result from failures of the mitochondria. Mitochondria are in every cell of your body except for red blood cells. So I don't know if you remember back to seventh grade biology, the powerhouse of the cell is typically what the mitochondria are called. They're little fuel-burning factories within the cell that are responsible for 90% of the energy that's needed by the body to sustain life. So what they do is they break down fat and protein and carbohydrates that you eat and the air that you breathe, and they turn it into chemical energy called ATP. So in a person with mitochondrial disease, the mitochondria are failing and can't convert food and oxygen into life-sustaining energy. So what happens is that cell injury and cell death follow, and if the process is repeated throughout the body, whole systems start to fail, and the life of the person in whom it's happening to starts to be severely compromised. So I like to explain it like trying to power a city with an incomplete or failing power grid. It's kind of like having a brownout.
Except with the power grid, you would know early on, because everyone would be aware that the power's gone out. How did you know that your daughter had a problem?
Well, when she reached about 10 weeks of life, she stopped growing. And no matter how much calories she would take in, she couldn't put on any weight. And she just had this whole multitude of symptoms that started to happen to her. She had all these GI issues, neurologic issues, and low muscle tone. And we just couldn't peg her into any one disease category. She didn't fit the description accurately for anything that we came across. So it was kind of like a flow chart is another way I like to look at it. You know, she was in the hospital and doctors were trying to figure out what was wrong with her. And mitochondrial disease certainly isn't where you would start. So we went through pretty much everything else you can think about. She had just about every test, but with an acronym and every letter of the alphabet as we tried to figure out what was wrong with her. She was tested for things like cystic fibrosis and a whole bunch of different diseases that she just kept coming back negative for.
And so at this very tender young age of 10 weeks, it sounds like the doctors ultimately tested her for this and gave you this information. And you had very limited places to go to for help. What was that experience like in terms of trying to figure out what exactly this means for Savannah's life and how to help her?
Well, we didn't really know how to help her. We just kept going from specialist to specialist, hoping that eventually someone would figure it out and put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And what ended up happening was she would have these odd labs And I really became skilled in Google University, and having had an experience of having an older child who had a rare disease, I learned how to research, and you wouldn't type into Google kid who has tumor, you would type in pediatric patient with neoplasm of the calvarium. And so I learned to do the same thing with Savannah, essentially. And she kept coming back with labs that I eventually came to learn were essentially red flags for mitochondrial disease. She would consistently have elevated lactic acid, and her pyruvate was high, and she had squirrely urine organic acids, and just things that I would, when I would type it into Google or any other kind of search engine, eventually I found out that they were red flags for mitochondrial disease.
So did you bring this to your doctor's attention?
I did. So what we ended up happening was I brought it to the attention of her pediatrician who had worked very closely with us, and she was an excellent gatekeeper of all the different specialists. And I think that's what you want in a good pediatrician in your first line, is to be a good manager of all the other specialists and keep everybody in communication. And she found, I had actually found a mitochondrial disease specialist who was in Atlanta, and we took her down there to have some testing done. She had a fresh muscle biopsy, which is generally considered the gold standard in testing for mitochondrial disease. And she had a bunch of labs done, and months later, they came back that we have excellent criteria for the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease.
We're talking with Amber Greenewald about her daughter, Savannah, and just receiving a diagnosis after a scary period of time when not knowing why she's failing to grow and having problems. And I wonder, Amber, if you can tell us what it was like to finally get a diagnosis. Was that a relief, or was it just the start of feeling like you have to take control here?
Well, chasing down a diagnosis was frustrating, but actually getting one can be devastating. So we were pretty overwhelmed in the beginning, but as we started to process the implications of it, it was also empowering, and we started to go after and find out everything that we could possibly do to help treat her and to prolong her life and give her the best quality of life that we possibly could. And, you know, initially in the place that we were at that time, we had neurologists who told us that she wouldn't ever walk or talk. And she's doing not only that, but much more. She's now running and lives with, you know, great joy every day. So we became pretty strong advocates for her. We knew that we needed to go to bat for her and do and seek out everything that we could.
And so what were the first things in terms of how to mitigate or learning options, or are there options for treatment? We may not be able, or we may need to take a break shortly, but I'd love to hear just the beginning of how you approached that.
Sure. Well, with each person with mitochondrial disease, the treatment has to be individually tailored to him or her, because people are biochemically different, so no two people respond to treatment in the exact same way. But one of the first things that we did for her was what most people who have mitochondrial disease end up doing, which is we put her on a cocktail of vitamins and cofactors like thiamine and riboflavin and niacin and folate, and high doses of coenzyme Q10. And these things don't really, it's not a cure, but what they do is they help prolong the life of the cells. So it doesn't necessarily stop or reverse what's already wrong, but it helps prevent the progression of the disease.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, let's pick up on the challenges of living and providing with a child with mitochondrial disease, and also the challenge that you took on of trying to educate the world, I think, which is a really important task we want to hear more about. So we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Amber Greenewald, about hope for rare diseases, mitochondrial disease. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the mitochondrial disease advocate, Amber Greenewalt, about mitochondrial disease as part of our second in our series on hope for rare diseases. And Amber, before the break, you were talking, you shared your experience receiving a diagnosis as a parent for your youngest daughter, Savannah, and learning to manage and try to prevent infections and taking cocktails and to provide vitamins. You've also then became very engaged in the community, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about how that transition happened from really receiving and focusing on first steps to thinking about what you need to do to educate the world.
Sure. It really wasn't too long after we received the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease that we decided that we did not just want to be a victim of the disease. We wanted to be a part of the cure. And so we set about gathering together. We formed a team of our family and friends called Saving Savannah, because that was what our goal was to do, was to save Savannah. And we set about supporting the efforts of the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation. The UMDF is the largest non-governmental supporter of research into mitochondrial disease, and that has the potential to lead us to a cure. And so one of the big events that they were just starting at that time was the Energy for Life Walkathon. They had all these different events across the country that were supporting the Mitochondrial Disease Foundation. And so they brought them all together under the umbrella of this walkathon. And so we set our efforts and our energies about being a part of that effort and helping to raise funds and awareness for mitochondrial disease. Because the biggest thing that I run into all the time is that people just don't know what it is, and I don't see a cure happening when people don't even know what it is. So that's the biggest and the first hurdle, I think, is to create awareness.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because we know that the American Cancer Society has the Relay for Life, and we've had the founder on our show and the remarkable story there and some of the real progress in cancer. And it sounds like it's probably no coincidence that this isn't a relay or a run. It's a walk. Talk to us about that and the metaphors here from a disease that everyone knows about and is willing to get invested in because so many people have experienced it, to a disease that maybe we don't know as many people.
We do it as a walk because a lot of people with mitochondrial disease can't even do a walk.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly couldn't do a run. And we want it to be as broad and far-reaching as possible. And so it's an event that is open to everyone. It's one of those things where you've got grandmas, grandpas, moms, dads, and kids all participating, and we want it to be something that everyone can do.
And so this has been something you got involved in, and then there was an extra push that you've called Saving Savannah. What's been the response in the community to rally and begin to understand mitochondrial disease?
When Savannah was first diagnosed, it was actually 3 weeks later that I was asked to chair the event, and at first I said no, because I just couldn't even wrap my brain around that. But then, like I said, I wanted to be part of the cure, so we set about doing this. We went up for some training to figure out how we were going to put this walk together, and we set out with very modest goals. We thought we wanted to have 300 people there and, raised $30,000, and the response in the community has just been overwhelming as people have gotten behind us. And our first year, I think we had 600 walkers come out, and the second year, 1,000 walkers, and last year we raised over $100,000.
Wow.
So it's definitely coming along. It's something that we would love to be able to bring. I think the great strides that have been made in the cancer world have come because there's now top-of-mind awareness about it. Everyone knows what breast cancer is, and everyone knows what, all kinds of different forms of cancer are, and we want the same thing to happen for mitochondrial disease, because the thing about mito and that I've learned is that you cure mitochondrial disease and you basically cure everything. You get at the heart of what makes mitochondria turn on and off, and you can make them function. You can cure everything from Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, ALS, just about anything. The aging process itself is due to mitochondrial dysfunction. So the implications would be far-reaching, and it's part of why I'm just so passionate about it.
So in your work and your research, Savannah's now 4,
yeah,
right? And we leapfrog from diagnosis to your engagement in community. and yet we return, you know, to her, and you're a mother and a family and other children. How's it going? How's she doing?
She is doing amazingly well. We just started her on some oxygen therapy, and that's one of those things that is just, again, designed to keep the mitochondria happy. And she's had extensive speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and she has made tremendous progress. So I consider us to be very, very lucky when it comes to mitochondrial disease, but it feels like every day we're losing kids to it. So we remain steadfast in our efforts to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I mean, the thing about mitochondrial disease is it can spiral so quickly. And these kids are so medically fragile, and you see it when they get something like an infection. So while we can do our best to keep her healthy and do all the therapies, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring.
I wonder how often you have the opportunity to counsel parents who receive this diagnosis for their children, and if so, or if you do in the future, what would you say are the most important things for them to know in looking forward?
Well, there's quite a bit I would tell a parent with a newly diagnosed kid. First, I would tell them to find support. Seek out resources like the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation and Mito Action. I would tell them that it's up to them to go to bat for their child, that they know their kid better than anyone else, and that it's up to them to be their child's best advocate. I would tell them to trust their instincts and to not assume, especially with mitochondrial disease, that a professional knows best, because it's one of those diseases where I've had to explain it myself to several doctors. So definitely become educated as you possibly can become yourself. I'd request all copies of things like medical records, and I know I put all of Savannah's into a big giant three-ring binder. I'd also suggest having specific protocols in place for emergency situations.
You know, when I hear about all the work you're doing and all the advocacy, you know, it's really a model for patients and having this alliance and team-based care. But I also sometimes, for the parent who is desperate, do you get approached or ever think about or have to deal with treatments that may be expensive but yet don't really offer a lot of benefit? Is that part of the whole cycle? How do you differentiate there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the CoQ10, for example, is still one of those things that you have to fight to get covered by your insurance because it's technically a supplement. It's one of those things where I just learned to keep at it. You learn really fast. You have to.
Where can people find out more information about your activities and about mitochondrial disease?
Well, Saving Savannah is on both Facebook and Twitter. So we would love, she's actually has a push for her fifth birthday. We'd love to reach 5,000 people about mitochondrial disease. So we would love for people to come check us out over on Facebook. And then great resources are the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, which is www.umdf.org, and the Mito Action website as well.
And we have two dates then that we also maybe want to promote. We have a birthday date that we can wish happy birthday.
And, yes, August 2nd will be her fifth birthday.
August 2nd, and then we also have the next walking for the
Energy for Life walkathon.
For the Energy for Life, and that is when?
October 12th, 2013 in Freedom Park.
Well, great. Well, those are two important dates that we can put them on our calendar, and we hope all of our listeners put them on their calendar. We really want to thank you, Amber Greenwald, for being on Your Health Today and advocating for Savannah, but also for the thousands of other parents and children who are affected with mitochondrial disease, and really hope for many rare diseases across the United States and the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Adam and I will talk a little bit about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have questions or comments that you want us to address on an upcoming show, send them to Christy and I at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, today on House Calls, we have questions about really when should one get a screening colon cancer examination.
About sweating excessively under the armpits and what you can do about it.
About warts, warts, warts.
And about having a baby at age 42.
Okay, let's listen to our very first house call about when to get a colon cancer screening.
My dad is 55 years old and has to have a colonoscopy. At what age should someone undergo this procedure?
Well, you're right to pick up on this and to advocate for your dad.
He should get it now.
Yeah, he should get it now.
Yesterday, preferably, but today will be okay.
The recommendation is starting at age 50 to have a colonoscopy, and if not a colonoscopy, another type of screening for colon cancer. But really, just getting that thing done is an important step to catch what could be a growing cancer, to catch it early before it even becomes cancer, and really make headway to prevent a devastating illness.
And the reality is the great majority of the colon cancer screenings will be normal, but a lot of them will take out those polyps, so the pre-kinds of cancers that could grow into cancer. So even though it may not have cancer, they may come up with this pre-cancer. And if you have risk factors, like someone who had colon cancer younger than age 50, probably needs to get that colonoscopy done even before age 50, if you had a father or brother that already had the colon cancer.
So, yes, get him to get that done. Let's take our very next house call question.
Is it normal to sweat excessively under your armpits?
Trick question here, Christy.
Well, is it normal? And then you say excessively. So it sounds like to you it's not normal and not something you enjoy.
No, and I'm not sure anyone enjoys getting sweating under the armpits. But having grown up here in the South, and I'm just thinking back to the 100-degree days that were all summer long, and when you walk from your car to your office that you start sweating. Sweating is normal. Sweating excessively, though, may be abnormal.
And there is a fancy word for it called hyperhidrosis. We can get our smart health sciences librarians to define that for us on our blog. But there are prescription medicines that if the regular over-the-counter deodorants and antiperspirants aren't working, there are prescription medicines that have aluminum chloride in them or aluminum tetrachloride, these different chemicals that can really make a difference.
So the bottom line answer is you don't have to suffer with sweating excessively, but you do have to probably take some medicines, some essentially super antiperspirants that can help you that your doctor can recommend. You might have to point them out to your doctor. Not all doctors may know this. So I agree, Christy. Let's put that term, the hyperhidrosis, there, along with maybe a couple of the recommendations of the different medicines that are used for this condition. Good idea.
That'd be great. Okay, let's do our next house call question about a child with warts.
My child has warts on the top of their shoulder and on their armpit. They've been frozen off by the dermatologists, but have grown back. Should I be worried, or will they eventually stop returning with additional treatments?
There's a lot of warts here. This is not a fun thing. I think warts are one of those experiences that almost everyone has experienced at some point in time, either on themselves, their children, a brother, sister, loved one, and as doctors, we've all seen them.
And the decision about what type of treatment and how frequent the treatment is really depends on the type of warts, where they are on the body, and the age of the child. There are lots of different treatments out there.
Well, and the first thing we should say is that quite a number of times, no treatment is an alternative because at least probably a third of the warts will be gone within 2 years, that they will go away with no treatment. The body just kind of resolves them.
Yeah, up to two-thirds, I read somewhere, resolve within 2 years.
So yeah, a large number.
You could go back and get an additional treatment if you want them to go away faster, or you can kind of wait and just see what happens.
And there's lots of different types of treatments. A lot of times on younger children, the freezing treatment's a little painful and it gets them kind of scared to come into the doctor. So that wouldn't be necessarily the first one that you might do, but it's not the last one either. And there are prescription medicines and there's topical medicines. A lot of those wart plasters that you can kind of tape on overnight and take off the next day, those are also possible as well.
Good luck to you. Warts are not fun.
Maybe we can put a little bit of information about warts on our website. One thing you shouldn't do, because it probably won't help, some people have heard of taking medications called Tagamet for warts, and people put it out there. These are typical antacids. Those really don't help. So we follow medicines that have been proven to help and be proven to be safe, particularly for children.
Well, speaking of safety, let's take our next house call about safety and being 42 with a baby.
My sister-in-law is 42 and is having her first child. At what age is it too risky for a woman to carry her first pregnancy?
At what age is it too risky? Well, we should first off talk about the risk of a normal pregnancy and then a risk at ages that are younger and older, because there are risks on both sides of that spectrum, right? If you get pregnant when you're 15 or when you're 45.
Sure. When you're pregnant as a teenager, there are lots of different issues with thinking about how you will care for the child, how you'll finish school, and lots of things that...
Getting access to prenatal care.
Yeah. That are of concern more in the social environment and home environment. And then as you get older, it is true, after you get into your late 30s and certainly at age 42, a woman is at higher risk for having a child with certain problems like Down syndrome or other problems where the chromosomes don't line up just right, are at higher risk of having a miscarriage. And it sounds like that's not happened, that your sister-in-law is about to have this baby, which is wonderful.
And the reality is a lot of women are starting to put off child-rearing and getting pregnant till their late 30s or even early 40s. So this is not all that unusual. And while it is a little more risky, the great majority of women conceive safe babies.
Absolutely.
At this age.
It is important. As you get older, you're more likely to have some underlying medical problems like diabetes or high blood pressure or something. So it's important to make sure you get good prenatal care and that you get those things checked out with your doctor.
When would be too risky, Christy? You're going to stay away from that question,
no,
aren't you?
I really am. I don't think, I think if you get pregnant, in your 40s, then that's a personal choice that you make. And if that's the way it's worked out, and you do have to be prepared. If you're going to try, then you may have more miscarriages. But I don't think there's an age cutoff where absolutely you should never do it. It's a lot more complicated and a more of a personal choice than that.
Good answer. Well, we want to thank all of you for your questions today. Wonderful house call questions. And if you want to send us your own questions, please send them to Christy and Adam at yourhealth@unc.edu or send them through our health app. You can search for Your Health, one word, and send us your questions.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Amber Greenewalt. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.